Hello, it's Debbie, back again, reading from the e-edition for the Decatur Herald and Review on Wednesday, January 18th, 2017. Starting on the front page, local lack of a state budget hurts Richland's bottom line. This is by Valerie Wells, a staff writer for H&R Decatur. Like other organizations in difficult financial times, Richland Community College has to reduce expenses and fewer employees have to do more work. Richland announced last week that 5 positions will be cut, including Lisa Gregory, Chief of Staff, Doug Brower, Vice President of Economic Development and Innovative Workforce Solutions, the Director of Human Resources, and 2 positions in the Duplication Center, which will close this spring. Human resources will migrate to the business office, said Greg Florian, Vice President of Finance and Administration. He will serve as interim director, while other staff will cover other duties such as oversight of benefits. It's a combination of things, Florian said. The biggest piece is the lack of state dollars. We were getting roughly about $2.5 million, and now we're getting $700,000. That's a fairly significant jump, so we didn't build any of that into this year's budget. When you complicate it with falling employment, and we guessed enrollment would drop a little bit, but they dropped more than we thought, then it's mixed with tuition being a bigger piece of revenue. It used to be 25%, and now it's 50%. In the budget, credit hours were estimated at 47,000, and actual enrollment was 45,000 credit hours. As of Tuesday, he told the Board of Trustees the budget shortfall was $182,000. Because fall enrollment was higher than expected, the net difference is $168,000, and that amount has to be made up somewhere for the college to break even on the year. Trustee Dale Coley asked if Florian could say which programs were experiencing lower enrollment, and College President Cristobal Valdez said that records aren't kept by program specifically, but because healthcare program students pay a higher rate, it's possible to see that enrollment in those areas is strong and the programs are in demand. Without much flexibility in expenditures, cutting expenses isn't easy. Florian suggested creating larger sections of some classes, which would require fewer adjunct faculty and cutting back on travel and equipment expenditures. Coley and Trustee Randy Price both discussed taking a look at programs and figuring out which ones are less in demand and which ones might lack the specific job training employers needed their employees to and might lack the specific job training employers need their people to have. With input from employers and adding those specific skills, Prince said, the college could draw more students who would finish their courses if they knew at the end they'd have jobs waiting. Do students understand the other side? Prince said, we need to be able to say 98% of the graduates of this program get a job at this salary. That's what they understand. In other business, the board heard a presentation from BLDD Architects on the proposed Carroll Center for Innovative Learning with an estimated cost of $3.6 million. BLDD asked for trustees' input on some design elements, such as placement and shape of the staircase leading to the second floor center. Construction is tentatively planned to begin in May. End of that article. Government and politics. 2 minimum wage proposals making state house rounds. This is by Debbie Hernandez, an H&R Springfield Bureau writer. Springfield. The new Illinois General Assembly will address 2 proposals on raising Illinois' minimum wage. As part of a bipartisan budget package being considered in the Senate, members proposed raising the minimum wage currently $8.25 an hour by 50 cents each year until reaching $11 in 2021. Meanwhile, a House bill would raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by October. In 2014 advisory referendum, about 63% of voters favored raising the minimum wage for adults from $8.25 to $10 by January 1st, 2015. Following the referendum, the Senate approved bills in 2014 and 2015 that would have raised the minimum wage to $11 by 2019. The House has not approved a minimum wage increase. The new Senate bill is being considered in conjunction with a grand bargain on the state budget that also includes tax increases, spending cuts, new casino licenses, and other proposals. State Senator Kimberly Lightford, Democrat Maywood, the bill's sponsor, was unavailable Tuesday for comment, but Democratic and Republican leaders in the Senate have said lawmakers from both parties will support all the pieces of the package. The sponsor of this House bill, State Representative Mary Flowers, Democrat, Chicago, said raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour is necessary because some employees must work two jobs to support their families that are in need of programs such as daycare and welfare. We are expecting them to do more with less, Flowers said. We need to provide them with the tools they need and that a wage of $15 an hour so they can pay their rent. Flowers added that a minimum wage of $11 an hour as proposed by the Senate is not sufficient for people's basic needs. Flowers said Illinois' economy would benefit by reducing spending on programs for low-income people. Raising the minimum wage would also help bring in more sales tax revenue because people who earn more would spend more, she said. James Muhammad, spokesman for the Service Employees International Union Healthcare Illinois, said the union agrees with Flowers that the minimum wage should be raised to $15 an hour. $15 is just a beginning, Muhammad said, but it is a start we feel would be significantly helpful to families who are trying to scratch out an existence in a time where price of basic necessities keep going up, but the wages stay stagnant. Muhammad said the state's proposal to gradually raise the wage to $11 an hour by 2021 would not help low-wage workers. Any proposal to raise Illinois' minimum wage will run into opposition from business groups. Mark Grant, state director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, said small businesses cannot afford the wage increases. They would need to find ways such as cutting jobs or reducing workers' hours to afford paying a higher wage, Grant said. He added that increasing the minimum wage would put some people out of business. Raising minimum wage pushes up salaries for all hourly rates, he said. If the government decides to do this, they have to find other ways to help businesses cope with the increase. Illinois' minimum wage was last raised in July 2010 from $8 to $8.25 as a result of a 2006 law. Surrounding states such as Indiana, Wisconsin, and Iowa have minimum wage of $7.25, which is also the federal rate. End of that article. Next, local. The doctor is in at Scoville Zoo. This is by Valerie Wells again. Decatur. Bud, a capybara, wouldn't take kindly to have his teeth meddled with by a veterinarian, so he had to be sedated for his checkup. Dr. Kenneth Welly of the University of Illinois, accompanied by a fourth-year veterinary medicine Dr. Kenneth Welly of the University of Illinois, accompanied by fourth-year veterinary and medicine students and an intern, made his regular rounds at Scoville Zoo recently. Bud hadn't been eating well, and Welly spent considerable time with him after he was out cold. The exam took so long that even Eden, the zoo's sloth, who was napping in her laundry basket suspended in the enclosure she shares with Bud, came out to have a look. This is about being proactive about the animal's health and getting them a once-a-year checkup to make sure they're doing well, said Ken Fry, zoo director. The tough part with an exotic animal is, in the wild, if you show you're injured or hurt, you become a target of prey. They always look for the weak and the injured, so a lot of animals suppress that unless you actually see a wound or a spike decrease in their food intake. You really don't know they're sick a lot of times. He depends on the animal's keepers to know each animal's personality and normal, healthy behavior and appearance, so they'll notice if something's a little off. Even a slight variation can indicate an illness, so the keepers have to be very alert. Animals in captivity tend to live longer than those in the wild, and sometimes old age creep up, such as arthritis, that would never be an issue with a wild animal. Just being in a zoo setting where we can help them and give them medication and treat injuries, most of the animals' lives are extended well beyond what they would be in the wild, he said. Jafari, the eldest of three cheetahs at Scoville, is 15. The zoo's chinchilla is 18. It was Heather Perdue, Bud's keeper, who noticed he wasn't eating as much as normal and seemed to be having trouble chewing. So Welly knew where to start in examining him. Capybaras resemble giant guinea pigs, and like smaller rodents, their teeth grow throughout their lives. Usually normal eating keeps Bud's teeth from getting too long, which is why Welly did a thorough exam to rule out other possible causes. She checks the animals in her care visually at least once a day, more if she suspects an illness or injuries. So that must be Heather they're talking about here. Keepers also watch the amount of food consumed and animal droppings. Changes in poop can be an early indication that something's wrong. Several of the zoo animals are used to being handled, including Bud, but when an animal is sick or in pain, and if the treatment's uncomfortable, it's just safer and less stressful for humans and animals if the animal is sedated. Bud had a nice nap while Welly worked on him with a towel over his eyes so he wouldn't be upset if he started to wake up and saw a lot of strangers gathered around him. During the most recent visit, Welly also checked on one of the zoo's kookaburras who had a broken beak and was cooperative during her exam and visited the new outdoor rabbit hutch. Some of the bunnies are losing weight, and Welly said the adjustment to living outdoors might be too much for them in spite of their new roomy quarters. Welly visits the zoo twice a month to make sure every animal gets an annual checkup and any animal with a medical need gets treated. We will try to look if we have some concerns from the keeper, Welly said. We also do a number of just health exams. Sometimes that's done annually, sometimes spread out a little longer than that, depending on the difficulty of the animal. Some species sedation is more risky for them, so we spread it out. We try to identify health problems as early in the process as possible. Obviously, we don't have that full hospital here, so there are some limitations to what we can do. We can't do radiographs and things like that, but we do full exams. We do blood work. They trim hooves on the goats and other maintenance work, as he calls it. Some of the animals are prone to periodontal disease, so they do dental cleanings for those. Not all the animals require sedation to be examined or cared for, like the kookaburra, who only had to be held by one of Welly's students. With older animals, he said, geriatric issues arise, and he monitors their quality of life as well as how that animal's health is affecting the group dynamic if the animal lives with others. It's really a wide variety of things we do when we're here, he said. Sometimes we talk about diets, and we have a keeper training program where we talk about diseases that humans and animals share. It's very much like we do with any pet species, except it's more complicated because many of these animals are not approachable, at least not in a handleable way. End of that article. On A2, we find a reminder that Comedy Hour with Bob Zaney and Chris Spire, 8:30 p.m., the main hangar, $15, is for mature audience and is tomorrow. One article on page 2, where normally they just have continuations from A1, national. Nearly 100 false killer whales die in South Florida. Miami. By the time rescuers returned to a mass stranding of false killer whales on the remote coast of southwest Florida early Sunday, most had died overnight, their corpses now drawing aggressive and hungry bull and tiger sharks. With water too dangerous to enter and chances of survival unlikely, the team turned their attention to unraveling what caused the mysterious deaths, now the largest stranding on record in the state. On Tuesday, Aaron Fugers, the program administrator for the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration Southeast Stranding Network, said rescue teams completed full necropsies on 6 of the whales, performed partial dissections on others, and collected tissue samples from nearly all of the 82 whales that have died. Another 13 remain missing. In the upcoming weeks, pathologists will look at blubber, skin, and tissue from the whales' organs to try to understand what drove so many of them into the brown, turbid waters near Hog Key and just north of Lost Man's River, a location about as remote and wild as any left in the state. There's a lot of different factors that could potentially cause it, said Fugers, listing changes in tide or unusual weather, water conditions such as red tide or military sonar exercises blamed for killing beaked whales. The strong social bond shared by the whales could also be their undoing. Healthy whales often follow the sick. Of all the different species, false killer whales also hold the record for the largest whale stranding ever, Fugere said. The Gulf of Mexico is routinely plagued with red tide outbreaks, with moderate to high amounts detected just this month far to the north. Over the past week, the state also began investigating a mysterious string of pelican deaths, leading U.S. Representative Charlie Crist to ask the Environmental Protection Agency to test water for toxicity. In a letter Tuesday, Fougere said it was unlikely the deaths are related. False killer whales are well known in Hawaii, where the deep ocean water they inhabit runs close to shore, and a local population routinely entertains fishermen and visitors with spiraling acrobatics. What is largely known about the species, among the largest members of the dolphin family, come from the studies done on the herd. So many are getting caught on long lines set for swordfish and tuna in waters near the islands. They were added to the endangered species list in 2012. But in Florida, they remain an enigma. Air-breathing mammals that live miles offshore in the Gulf of Mexico, where they dive nearly 900 feet in search of tuna, octopuses, and other deep-sea marine life to eat. The last time the Gulf whales were surveyed in the 1990s and early 2000s, fishery experts put their numbers between about 100 and 1,000. But today that information is considered too outdated to be valid. So government assessments list the herd as unknown. Herd size. As unknown. Members of the FWC stranding team based in Port Charlotte hurried after them, but it wasn't until 3 p.m. with staff from the Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota also on the scene. The teams had the manpower necessary to coordinate efforts, made even more difficult by the lack of cell phone service. Okay, end of that article. On to A3, Government and Politics, Nelson Park Amphitheater Gets City Okay. This is by Chris Lusvardi, and Herald and Review staff writer, Decatur. Design of the Nelson Park Amphitheater project will be moving ahead after the Decatur City Council approved Tuesday funding its share of the work. The city is planning to contribute $181,700 for splitting in half the costs of engineering and professional services with the Decatur Park District. The Howard G. Buffett Foundation is paying for most of the $3.9 million project after it was delayed more than a year when a grant fell through that was meant to pay for part of its construction, which is expected to begin this spring. Work could be finished by the end of the year. Not all the council members were in favor of providing city funding for the project, although only Pat McDaniel voted against it. "We do need to watch every penny," Councilman Jerry Dawson said. "This is something that would be good for the community. Anything to bring people into the community is a good thing." Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said the city is looking for a boost to the lakefront, similarly to what has occurred downtown after renovation projects were completed in recent years. "I hope we see the lakefront do the same thing," Moore Wolf said. McDaniel voted against providing the funding because he said citizens and businesses have had to take on financial burdens of city tax and rate increases to fund infrastructure projects. McDaniel issued a statement explaining his decision, pointing to other performance revenues in the area, most of which did not receive taxpayer subsidies. Although the Nelson Park Amphitheater sounds like some is a much-needed, financially sound community endeavor, the amphitheater will have a small seasonal window of opportunities for use by the public, McDaniel said. He would rather city fundings, but toward needed infrastructure projects, such as the more than $12 million worth of work the city council approved toward the goal of repairing sewers. The council approved the nearly $8 million bid of SAKA Construction to provide repair work on sewers over a large portion of the city's west side. That work is on track to begin in March and continue through the fall of 2018. In addition, it approved $4.8 million to provide for construction engineering and resident inspection services for the Nelson Park Neighborhood Combined Sewer Separation Project. After construction work for that project is bid, it's likely to start this summer and continue through fall 2018. End of that article. Continuing to public safety, third-generation law enforcement officer hangs up uniform. This is by Huey Freeman, also from the Herald and Review, Decatur. Chris Peters spent part of his childhood living near the jail. As son of Macon County Sheriff Charles Peter, the family lived in the sheriff's quarters in the 1960s on the fifth floor of the courthouse. On the weekends, we played on the elevators and stairs. We had the run of the place, kind of like Mayberry, said Peters, 56, who's retiring after 30 years on the Decatur Police Department, effective Friday. A first shift patrol sergeant, Peters has followed in the footprints of his father and grandfather, David Peters, who also served as Macon County Sheriff. Chris Peters' law enforcement career includes service as the coordinator of the Distinguished Fatal Accident Investigation Team and DUI coordinator. Peters has just been promoted to sergeant when patrol officer Robin Vogel was killed by a drunken driver in a crash in 2005. After department leaders decided to become more aggressive, arrest numbers soared from about 40 to 50 each year to 730 in 2009, second highest of any city in the state besides Chicago. In 2014, Decatur police arrested 477, first in that category. When Peters first tested to become an officer at 21, he failed the physical test. He went to work for UPS, loading and unloading trucks while attending college. However, he kept up his dream of keeping the family tradition alive by joining the Decatur Police Auxiliary Force. He served as a volunteer officer for 3 years before becoming a paid officer. Like many new officers, he was put on the overnight shift. I had the hardest time adjusting to the hours, Peter said. I couldn't sleep. During training, I questioned if I'd made the right choice. He spent 13 years working on the graveyard shift altogether as a patrol officer or sergeant. He was promoted to master patrol officer and served as a field training officer. Although he's hanging up his uniform, Peters will remain active serving law enforcement. On Monday, he will begin his new career as Safety Grant Administrator for the Illinois Department of Transportation. I love my job. I hate to leave it, Peters said, but I won't have to answer the phone in the middle of the night or do monthly reports. Police Chief Jim Getz said Peters had done a great job, especially with the Fatal Accident Investigation Team, DUI Enforcement, and writing grants for additional DUI hire-back officers. Chris was an expert in fatal accident investigations, which was beneficial to the department, Getz said. They helped out the state and the county. They do a great job and are one of the best in the area, which is related to the effort Sergeant Peters put in. End of that article. Next, state and regional. The Mill, Route 66 Icon, to reopen as museum. This is Kevin Barlow, Lee News Service writer. Lincoln. Lincoln resident Terry Schroyer remembers growing up around the Mill, a former Lincoln restaurant and Route 66 icon that has been closed since 1996. Her great-grandparents, Albert and Blossom Huffman, bought the Mill in 1945. They ran it when I was a little girl, and the upstairs was their home where there was a beautiful apartment, she said. After their deaths, their son and his wife, George and Eleanor Huffman, took ownership. The food was always so amazing, Schroyer said, and everyone knew everyone. By the time the restaurant closed in 1996, it had turned into a part-time museum. In 2006, the Route 66 Heritage Foundation of Logan County was created to promote and preserve the Mill and other Route 66 sites in Logan County. In 2009, Landmarks Illinois, a statewide preservation advocacy group, named the site at 738 South Washington in Lincoln on the Route 66 corridor on the state's most endangered historical places list. In April, the Mill will reopen as a full-time museum following the completion of restoration work, said Jeff Ladd, the secretary of the Restoration Committee. We're thinking mid to late April is having a grand opening, Ladd said. We have made it to the final stages of this project. To comply with state laws, new restrooms had to be added to the back of the building. Funds came from the National Park Service grant of $22,720 and nearly $16,000 of grant money from the City of Lincoln from hotel motel taxes. It's not a burden on local taxpayers, which we think is very important, Ladd said. The critical step was to have the functioning restrooms completed. They had to be compliant with all the new laws, and yet we wanted to make sure it still stayed as much as of an historical context as possible. Lads at the Museum will feature Route 66 memorabilia. We want to make it specific to Lincoln and Logan County as much as we can, he said. We have some items left from the mill, but not as much as we would have liked. It was abandoned and looted all the time, and so a lot of items we would have liked to have kept or had access to are gone. Other memorabilia from Route 66, such as the former Pig Hip Museum, will be featured, Ladd said. The Pig Hip was once a popular eatery in Broadwell that was turned into a museum but was destroyed by fire in March 2007. We will also feature some memorabilia from some important Route 66 lodging locations and also some famous people from Lincoln and Logan County, he said. We want to add as much local flavor to the museum as we can. Funding from the museum is expected to come from donations, a membership program, and merchandise proceeds, Ladd said. End of that article. Crime in courts. Man accused of beating 4-year-old boy. This is by Tony Reed for the H&R staff. Decatur. A Decatur man was arrested and jailed after allegedly handing out repeated beatings to a 4-year-old boy. The 47-year-old suspect was taken into custody by police Monday evening following an investigation. Sworn statement said the alleged abuse of the child, who suffers from speech delays, first came to light when the teachers of his school noticed extensive bruising while changing his pull-up diaper. Asked what had happened, the kid is said to have replied, "Daddy hit." Later examined by a doctor, the boy was found to have widespread bruising to his shins, back, arms, and face. The doctor described the injuries as consistent with abuse. The boy's mother, age 36, told police the suspect was verbally and physically abusive to the boy. She stated that he makes frequent statements like, "I don't care if I lose you to DCFS and I don't want you anymore." The mother also said she'd seen the suspect grab the boy by his upper arm and yank him around when he's in trouble. The suspect, who has previously served a prison sentence for domestic battery, is now facing charges of aggravated battery of a child and committing domestic battery while having a prior. He was in jail Tuesday night in lieu of posting $18,000 bond. If he makes bail, he's been ordered to stay away from the child and the family home. He's due to be arraigned on February 17th. Finally, we go to the local shorts, briefs they call them. Clinton, prison term commuted. A Clinton man is among 273 individuals given a second chance by President Barack Obama. Christopher E. Webster's prison sentence for drug charges has been commuted to expire January 17, 2019, with the condition that he enroll in a drug treatment program. Decatur, shoplifter addressed. An alleged serial shoplifter with a taste for soap and air fresheners who repeatedly targeted the same Decatur Dollar General store was arrested Monday night and jailed on burglary charges. Sworn statement said the manager of the store at 969 East El Dorado Street showed surveillance video of the 61-year-old suspect helping himself to hands full of soap, air fresheners, and 12 bottles of Dawn Power Clean dish soap, stuffing the items into his coat pockets and walking out. The manager said the suspect targeted his store on multiple occasions and has been thrown out of the business as recently as Monday. When arrested, police quote the suspect as saying he'd been smoking narcotics and drinking heavily and he couldn't remember stealing. Continuing, Decatur, man bites finger. A Decatur man is facing charges. He punched another man to the ground and then bit the victim's finger so badly the bone was fractured and the wound needed 4 stitches to close. Sworn police statement said the assault happened in Kent Circle in Park City on December 22nd. Police caught up with and arrested the suspect Friday. The statement said the victim had just driven up with a woman friend when he was set upon by the 44-year-old suspect and an accomplice. The suspect allegedly punched the victim so hard he fell over. Then he then bit the suspect on the shoulder and savaged the man's left middle finger. The accomplice also allegedly kicked and punched him several times. The suspect was jailed on charges of aggravated battery and mob action. That is the end of the briefs, end of the A3 page, and also the end of part one of the Wednesday, January 18, 2017 e-edition of the Decatur Herald and Review as read by Debbie. I will talk to you soon.